This is one of those R&B tracks with such a rich history. This is a Ray Charles version recorded in October of 1958, but 20 years earlier in 38, it was recorded by Big Bill Brunzi with slightly different and more suggestive lyrics. Bob Dylan referred to this song in his 1969 track To Be With the One You Love, and James Brown recorded it in 1983. It was the B-side of his single, Bring It On, Bring It On. Ray Charles, The Nighttime Is the Right Time. You got that right. Hey, if you like what you're hearing from me here on Coast to Coast tonight, I hope you'll check out my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show. It airs Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern out of Toronto on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. It's a monster 50,000-watt blowtorch station. You can pick it up. Well, you can pick up the signal up and down the eastern seaboard, Maine to Minnesota, northern Ontario, Quebec, down to the Carolinas. So for a list of affiliates, just go to my website, strangeplanet.ca. The Conspiracy Show app is a free download, and then you can stream the show and listen while you're on the go. And don't forget the YouTube channel, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. We stream the show on YouTube most Sunday nights. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Back with more of my conversation with Michael Kimmelman, Confessions of a Wall Street Insider, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Michael Kimmelman stays with us, Confessions of a Wall Street Insider. Michael, the whole concept of insider trading, I think, is confusing to working class people. I know part of this cautionary tale is about how incredibly nebulous and ill-defined the rules are for inside trading. What is inside trading in a nutshell?
So it's really a few standards or elements of the crime, and it is material, non-public information that's acquired in breach of a fiduciary duty, and whoever uses it has to have knowledge that it was acquired in that breach, and there has to be some benefit paid. So at heart, it's materiality just means that the information is important, that it would alter the total mix of information out there. Non-public is exactly what it sounds like, that it's not widely disseminated information. And there has to be some type of special duty, whether it's a fiduciary duty or a duty of confidentiality, that somebody breaks as well. And you're exactly right, though. Unfortunately, it's never actually been defined by Congress. So there is no statutory definition of insider trading. It's actually been a patchwork quilt of judge-made law, and as was evident in my case and many other cases, sometimes those judges don't even agree on the law. So it is a very gray and nebulous area, unfortunately. There's plenty of black and white cases as well, but I think the overwhelming majority fell into, as well as the investigations, fell into this gray area at times, which is obviously unfortunate.
And in your particular case, the insider trading dealt with trading stocks in a company called 3DCOM. And how did you get caught up in that, and how were Zvi and New Agoffer involved?
So 3DCOM was the stock, and at heart, it was just a call from Zvi, and it was a tip. And again, tips are not illegal. But that was something I think that obviously was confusing to the jury. But, you know, when I would go to a cocktail party or anywhere else and people would find out I was a Wall Street hedge fund guy or a trader, you know, they'd ask, you know, do you have any tips for me, or what are you buying? What do you like? So in this case, there were many different traders that I exchanged ideas with. Zvi was one of those traders. And I think we exchanged something like 380 trading ideas, or traded the same stocks in tandem over the course of the previous year or so. And in this case, Zvi called me and said something to the effect of, hey, I'm hearing from some of my smart money guys that 3DCOM's in play, and I like this one, and I'm buying it for size, meaning he was buying a large position. So he did not obviously reveal anything more than that as far as where he got the stock from, or that it was acquired illicitly, or anything else. It was a tip, not unlike any other tip he had given me. I bought that stock and then traded it up and down for, I think, 2 months. And then 2 months later, the stock got taken over. And that was the trade that I got arrested for 2 years after that. And, you know, again, this was a stock that was in the Wall Street Journal probably 10 days before Zvi tipped me that he was buying it and he was hearing good things about it, the Wall Street Journal had run a story on the stock saying it was in play, which is what Zvi said, that the acquirer, they actually had the name of the acquirer, which was Bain Capital, and the price, which was the low five. So as well as, you know, Goldman Sachs is the banker. So the Wall Street Journal had a whole hell of a lot more information than Zvi ever told me. But again, that was the eventual trade that I was arrested for.
But the day that the trade supposedly took place, you had a pretty ironclad alibi. Weren't you celebrating your father-in-law's retirement party at the Federal Reserve? You were sitting at a table with Ben Bernanke at the time?
I was, and Alan Greenspan. So, you know, in the criminal complaint, it says on August 7th, Zvi tipped myself, as well as I think they list six or seven other people in the criminal complaint, and that we traded 3Com. And it's a formal legal document. And when I showed that to my lawyer, he said, all right, so you traded it on August 7th. I said, August 7th, I was at the Federal Reserve. I didn't have access to a computer or a phone or anything else. Obviously, they go into embargo stage when they do the decisions on interest rates. And this was, like you said, it was my father-in-law's retirement dinner. He was a Federal Reserve, president of the Chicago Federal Reserve. And we were, you know, at lunch with Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke. And Ben Bernanke was talking to my younger nephew, who was about 10, about the Yankees and the Red Sox. And Alan Greenspan was talking to my wife at the time about vegetables. So I was not tipped by any measure until, you know, I think it was the next night when I got home that V actually told me about it. But as my lawyer said, look, if they can get the date wrong in a criminal complaint, that's the most simple, obvious thing that, you know, that they could print. You know, it makes you question the rest of the veracity of the document.
So how were they monitoring you? How did they, I mean, were employees at Incremental were they wired? How did they get you?
I mean, this was, again, it was a little bit like an episode of The Wire. And I was a guy who was oblivious to it all. And again, even if I wasn't drinking, I think I would have been oblivious to it. It's just, I had never even imagined something like this was possible. But apparently, there was at least one person who was an FBI informant who was sitting on the trading desk, literally right next to me, an arm's length away for 18 months, wired up, trying to incriminate me at every stage and recording conversations and whatnot. And then they also had our phones were wiretapped, and there were three or four other informants who were wearing body wires who at certain points either tried to get a job with Incremental or were offering to write a $10 million check. One of these informants, David Slane, had been busted himself for some type of financial fraud, you know, and literally came in a couple times and said, you know, I've got a check for $10 million. I want to be a partner in Incremental. And, you know, I want access to information and everything else. And we met with him and others, and I ended up meeting with them as well. So it was phones, it was emails, it was instant messages. But most interesting was, you know, the FBI informant who was a friend of mine, who had gotten into trouble, or at least, you know, he was actually coerced, I think, into wearing a wire. I don't believe that he actually even committed a crime, but at the same time, if you don't have money and the feds roll up on you and say, you know, you're going to go to jail for 5 to 10 years unless you help us, you'd be surprised at how many people will put on a wire or say something or do something to avoid, you know, the threat and fear of prison. So he put on a wire and sat next to me, but the Fed did not even call him at trial, which to me says an enormous amount. This was a 2-year investigation. There was a guy sitting next to me, wired up every day, trying to incriminate me, and they didn't even bother to call him at trial. So there was, you know, this case was ridiculous for many reasons, but I think that says a whole hell of a lot about it, about the, you know, substance of the case.
And then as you're looking back, as you're awaiting trial, and you're trying to think back to episodes with the Goffer brothers, V and New, and trying to figure out, was there something there? Was there a hint that something was going down? And at one point, I think you approached News Desk, and he had scribbled something down on a Post-it note. And when he saw you coming, he shoved it in his mouth, he chewed it, and he swallowed it. What other clues were, and then I think he, then you started calling him the human shredder, or he referred to himself that way, but what other clues were they that they were up to some, they were up to no good?
That was actually Zvi, and Nu had passed him the note. And Zvi, I don't think he ate it when he saw me. I think he was in the process of eating it when I walked over. And, you know, to understand Zvi, you have to understand he was, again, a con man and a grifter and very charming, but also liked to cultivate an image that he was a big shot and a mover and a shaker, and that he had, you know, Stevie Cohen, who was another big hedge fund manager, on his auto dial, and Raj Rajaratnam was a close friend and on his auto dial, and, you know, tried to position himself and did have some very good connections in the industry, but loved to cultivate that image of, you know, I'm a guy who's connected to lots of people, and I'm also a bit of a rogue, in that, you know, he would commonly say, hey, I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you, or, you know, you don't need to know, or it's a need to know basis. But, you know, when you pressed him on certain things, like more than once I asked him, you know, you're not talking to any bankers or lawyers, are you? Because I know, you know, having come from Sullivan and Cromwell, having gone to law school, having done the insider trading compliance training, I understood insider trading certainly better than the prosecutor, certainly better than law enforcement, and better than, you know, obviously probably 99% of the people out there. I realize that sounds a little bit absurd in retrospect, but I understood what the law was. And so, you know, asked him on more than one occasion, you're not talking to bankers or lawyers, which is really how you get in trouble. It's by talking to an insider. And he would say, of course not. You know, no way. You know, I know you've told me that's the only way, or one of the only ways you get in trouble. And if you listen to the wiretaps, he talks to David Slain, some of the other informants, and says the same type of thing. Like, I would never talk to a banker or a lawyer. So, you know, he would profess that this was, you know, a much more roundabout way, talking to hedge fund guys, they're hearing things. And in those types of situations, that has never been prosecuted. And it's, you know, in my opinion, and the opinion of many others, it's not a crime, because you have no way to assess the credibility of the information, the credibility of the sources or the intermediaries, or how many sources there are. So, in certain insider trading cases, there were many that were overturned, as well as some that weren't charged. You could be talking to somebody three, four, five, six, you know, connections away. So it becomes like a game of telephone tag almost, or a ladder, and you're really just playing rumors. And in those cases, half the time, I would take the other side of the trade because I didn't believe the trade. But Zvi was a master at you know, portraying that image. And as I talk about in the book, there were times where he was on the phone with Rajaratnam and talking about, you know, Raj is going to put $10 million into incremental at least, and this and that. And now when I look back and when I got the wire taps and you could see when he was talking to Raj, I would, you know, cross-check and look at those times. And he was never on the phone with him. He was just sort of talking into a dead telephone, pretending to be on the conversation. So, you know, he was a classic con man in many ways.
Why did the I guess it's called the Southern District, why did they come after the hedge fund managers after the crisis? Was it because you guys were low-hanging fruit? They wanted to make an example out of you? Why?
This was, I think, a very deliberate decision. This was the height of the financial crisis, and again, rather than going after the causes of the financial crisis or, you know, doing a real investigation that might have yielded some targets, you had insider trading, which was a lot easier to understand than CDOs or mortgage fraud. Everybody's seen Oliver Stone's Wall Street. Everybody understands what a stock is, or most people. So in this case, it was a very simple and convenient narrative that either the administration or Preet Bharara was able to sell to an angry public to show that, you know, allegedly they were doing something about the financial crisis and on the case. But this was really a preordained storyline where the cases were chosen to fit that storyline rather than a real investigative approach. But this allowed them to parade some very wealthy people in handcuffs out in public view and say, look, you know, we're on the case. And the public was angry, and justifiably so. So I think this was a deliberate whitewash in many ways.
You're right. I think most people, when they think of the financial crisis, 2000, 2008, they don't think of necessarily. The execs at Goldman Sachs, they think of the Bernie Madoffs and they think of the hedge fund managers. Your trial was being conducted just a few hundred yards from where the Occupy Wall Street movement protests were happening. My sense is not a lot of sympathy to this day for the hedge fund managers that went to jail like yourself. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Whether it's fair or not remains another, question. But people generally don't have sympathy for, what they perceive as people who are not playing by the rules or people who have a lot of money. I mean, it's a very difficult time in our country, and this has been going on. It's certainly exacerbated now by the press and some of the political strife, but this has been going on for 15, 20 years. There has been rampant income inequality, it's always easy to point to somebody with either money or that you think did something wrong and sort of portray them as the cause of something that happened. But in this case, I mean, if you have any financial understanding, you can say with no uncertainty that insider trading had 100% nothing to do with the financial crisis. But it was an easier narrative or story to understand. So, to go after mortgage fraud, and there was trillions of dollars in mortgage fraud, or even somebody like Bernie Madoff, where there were real victims and he stole money, or any number of other people who were at least partially responsible for the financial crisis, including, our legislative bodies who passed policies and laws that certainly made it a lot more likely to happen, would require going after real wealth and the real causes. And when you do that, unfortunately, you risk losing. And I hate to say it, but the ultimate calculus and decision that gets made by whether it's an administration, with a political angle, or the Southern District, or any other prosecutor, what it comes down to is career calculus, and it's money. So if they can arrest somebody and prosecute them in a case that makes the papers and gets a little bit of publicity, that's tremendous for their careers. That means when they leave public service, they will get a job at a big law firm and get paid millions of dollars a year. So it's a lot easier to choose a case where everybody who's seen Wall Street or can understand, hey, this guy talked to a banker or a lawyer or a CEO, you're not allowed to do that. Let's arrest him rather than going after, again, the mortgage fraud or the Ponzi schemes or any number of other things that led to the financial crisis. I mean, that would be like, during 9/11, instead of going after the terrorists or the causes of the people who, took down the towers, it'd be like going after like the New York developers who, they didn't make the building sturdy enough. Let's go investigate or arrest them. It was a way to take the public's eye off the ball and create this false narrative.
Right. And it's that revolving door problem again, which is part of that swamp that the current occupant of the White House is trying to address, I suppose. We talk a lot about
huge problem. Yeah. It's, you have regulatory capture, as I write about in the book, on nearly every level. The same people that are charged with investigating, whether it's the banks or politicians or anybody else, are very conscious about, hey, when I leave public service or when I'm done here, I want to make sure that I'm going to get a job that's going to pay me a lot of money and isn't going to piss off the wrong people. So it's a lot easier, again, to find somebody who you perceive is not playing by the rules, but who is not politically connected, and go after them and either, prosecute or create a case or an image that somehow this guy is, this financial Lex Luthor and we got him. And now it's safe to keep your money in the stock market. It's safe to go buy a house again. It's safe to, keep money in banks and everything else. And, you basically ameliorated an angry public. But it, again, I don't think it's worked entirely that well. I think in retrospect, a lot of the studies that have been done and a lot of the analysis post-financial crisis realizes now that this was sort of a very cynical move by either the administration or Preet Bharara or the
right
district.
All right, Michael, we're up against a break. We'll come back. I want to talk about criminal conspiracy charges. That term comes up a lot on this program, as you can imagine. And I will also open up the phone lines. Questions and comments from Michael Kimmelman, Confessions of a Wall Street Insider. Here's Elvis Presley and a nice little remix of Bossa Nova Baby on Coast to Coast AM. Is this a case of prosecutors placing a political agenda and career ambition over truth and justice? Is Michael Kimmelman simply an example of collateral damage? Well, you'll tell us when you call in with your questions and comments right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Kimmelman, Confessions of a Wall Street Insider. Michael, when you sat down with your lawyer, Michael Sommer, and he walked you through the options you had for the trial, you could have copped a plea and avoided a trial. You could have agreed to cooperate possibly avoided jail time, or you could have basically decided not to cooperate. Which decision did you make and why?
I decided not to cooperate and to go to trial, but before that happened, I was offered a very unusual plea from the government. So in these types of cases, typically, like you said, those are the three choices. Either you just plead guilty, either you cooperate and plea, which in our system, cooperators are more or less given a free pass, meaning they get no jail time, in order to help, you know, prosecutors prove up a case against another defendant, or you go to trial and try to exercise your constitutional rights. In my case, they came back to me the day of my indictment. So I was arrested in November and they indicted me in February and said, look, we realize you're a peripheral player at best and very different than the others in there, which is, you know, unfortunate that they didn't do the investigation prior to arresting me on that, because I don't think they would have arrested me, nor do I think they would have arrested me today or, you know, in 2003. But they said, plead guilty to one count of conspiracy. You don't have to cooperate and you'll get no jail time. So you'll get probation. And when I talked to other prosecutors and other lawyers, they said that was extraordinarily rare. It's very unusual to indict somebody and spend years investigating them, arrest them, and then just offer them, you know, a probation plea without cooperation. So that was a very good deal. And, you know, a lot of the media and part of the book certainly looked at that and said, why the hell didn't you take the deal? And, you know, I decided to pass on that deal and to go to trial. And that was obviously, you know, a decision that many people looked at me in retrospect and thought I was out of my mind for taking that approach. But for me, it was very simple. I didn't think I did anything wrong, and I wasn't about to get up in front of a judge and perjure myself and say that I knew it was inside information and I knew I was acting on inside information. So I chose to go to trial.
Criminal conspiracy. That term comes up a lot on Coast to Coast, conspiracy, and people often will use the term conspiracy theory in the pejorative to stifle discussion on something or to discredit somebody. But it's part of the criminal justice system, criminal conspiracy, but it's a vast fishing net. I believe that's Martha Stewart ended up going to prison on criminal conspiracy charges. But, I mean, I think you were dumbfounded. You write about your lawyer, or it was your friend Mo, who was in the district attorney's office, explaining that about half the people currently in prison get caught up in this criminal conspiracy charge. You don't even have to commit the crime. You simply have to think about it.
It is one of these things that it's a peculiarly American thing, because I don't believe it exists anywhere else in the world. And as my lawyer said, and many people have commented, most of the people in prison are in prison for conspiracy. Now, you know, it's a different analysis than conspiracy theory or other conspiracies. In the criminal context, conspiracy just means that you have the intent to commit a crime at some point in the future, and you have to take at least a concrete step towards committing that crime. But in reality, the way our system is set up, and the tremendous institutional biases that exist in favor of the government, taking that concrete step, towards further committing the crime can be something as simple as a phone call. And that's all it was. In my case, they tried to say, you know, Z giving me a phone call And mind you, this was the phone call I ended up being, you know, there was the majority of the evidence was one that the Fed didn't even tape. So they didn't record it, and they instructed the jury to speculate that on that call, I must have been told about an inside source because I went out and bought the stock. Never mind the fact that, you know, I went out and bought stocks off, you know, thousands of calls or emails or instant messages. But, you know, in the context of conspiracy, it could be something very minimal. And, you know, conspiracy is something that should be reined in or at least looked at. In drug cases, many people are there for it. It takes very little to convict someone of it. And if you look at my case, again, this is insider trading. It is technically a victimless crime. So nobody lost money from the trade I made. It doesn't mean that it's right. It's certainly illegal under the law. It should be prosecuted. But there are no victims. It's not like Bernie Madoff where somebody gave him money and he stole it or lost it. In this case, if you buy a stock and it goes up, you own that stock. It still goes up. So you actually made money in this case. But with regard to conspiracy, it makes sense. You know, if it's Jack Bauer, you know, in 24 and somebody's trying to blow up Grand Central or, you know, detonate a nuclear weapon in the United States, you don't want to have to wait until they actually commit the crime to be able to prosecute them or arrest them. That's where conspiracy makes sense, where there's threat to property or person, and it's important to get in front of it. In a case like insider trading, you know, it's hard to say that conspiracy, that you can prosecute somebody without them even making a trade, because what's the harm in allowing that trade to happen and seeing if it actually, you know, is a crime? So it made no sense in my case. And even worse is that people argue over it and don't really understand it. I mean, we had, you know, the judges and prosecutors and lawyers, people who do this for a living and supposedly have 20, 25 years of experience, had trouble agreeing on what it meant, you know, what the elements were. One of the prosecutors actually during a pretrial hearing said I wasn't being even charged with a substantive crime. The only crime I was being charged with was conspiracy. And therefore, you know, in an insider trading case, I didn't even need to make a trade. So it is a very nebulous concept that allows the government to go out and grab, you know, people, not indiscriminately, but certainly a very wide net it provides. And it's a hammer. So, you know, in a drug case, you could have somebody say, hey, do you know where I can buy some weed? I'm coming into town. And if you say, well, you know, I don't smoke or I don't know, but I have a friend who knows, that's conspiracy to, you know, distribute marijuana. And I met people in prison for that crime for 5 years. So if you think about it in that context, it's a pretty outrageous violation of civil liberties, and it sort of has a very police state ring to it.
You write about in the book how the feds were trying, before the trial, trying to get you to cop a plea or trying to get you to cooperate. They, at one point, they froze your accounts. They even tried to freeze your wife at the time was running a catering business. They went in and froze her accounts, and you came to the conclusion this was the feds trying to pressure you.
It is, and it happens on an everyday basis, and it's really something that's shameful. You know, these are tactics that belong, you know, that we used to mock when former Soviet or KGB agents or the Stasi would utilize those types of tactics. They have no place in a, you know, supposedly free society. So this is pre-trial. You're still presumed innocent, which I realize is a complete legal fiction and almost laughable after seeing what I saw in the criminal justice system. But we had agents following my family, menacing us. They shut down my bank accounts. They shut down, like you said, my wife's business accounts. You know, they took extraordinary steps in order to elicit a plea or to pressure me into not going to trial. And something like that, again, should offend you if you feel that the Constitution is a real document and that civil liberties are important. I mean, in our case, the feds acted in a way that was really shameful in many ways. I mean, they had the FBI listening in on the wiretaps to privileged conversations. So conversations between attorneys and clients, conversations between husbands and wives. I mean, you don't have to be a lawyer to understand that under the Constitution, that's illegal and you're not allowed to do it. And yet they did it. You know, they even allegedly planted a bug in the bedroom of a husband and wife. And the FBI actually ended up settling a case that was brought by the wife on that bug as, you know, a civil liberties violation. And that's probably the first case of its kind that, that has actually ever been brought or settled. So, you know, when you think about government overreach or a police state or Big Brother or any of those other things, you know, there's a real war going on. And I'll say it again, and you can read all about it in the book quite a bit. Everything that happened in my case was a precursor for what we're seeing now, whether it's, you know, the political wiretapping or unmasking of political opponents or investigating political opponents, or many of the other, you know, the press, the loss of faith in the press. You know, you saw in my case just completely mischaracterized stories. In my case, I was the only one without a burner phone, the only one that didn't pay cash bribes. That was the cornerstone of some of our defense at trial, and that you would open up the paper the next day, and it were a magazine, and it would say something to the effect of, you know, Kim Ullman used a burner phone and paid cash bribes. So, you know, you see it all in this case, including the government overreach and the violation of civil liberties, which I think were outrageous and should concern every citizen.
All right, let's take a call or two, time permitting. Wild card, Mike is in West Palm Beach, Florida. Mike, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Yeah, hi, how you doing? A couple things I want to bring up. Very good video, YouTube thing you should watch is The Lost World of Communism about East Germany. How the secret police, the thing that the Stasi, the secret police, many of the things you mentioned, they were doing in East Germany under the communist rule. You should watch the program. It's very interesting about informers, the whole setup there. It's in there. Second thing I want to bring up concerning President Trump. Now, I know you don't know anything about this. I'm going to give you a situation. I want your opinion about it. All right. 10 years ago, Donald Trump bought a mansion on West Palm and Palm Beach for $40 million. He hoped to make a quick turnover and make some profit on it. But after 2 years, no one wanted it. After 2 years, this corrupt Russian billionaire comes along and gives him a check for $100 million for that property. It isn't worth $40 million or $30 million. My opinion is that was a payoff by the Russians. And from that point on, I think he was controlled by the corrupt Russian mafia, whatever they got running there. That's only my opinion. I'd like to have your opinion about it.
All right, Michael, I don't know if you want to weigh in on that one or not.
Yeah, I don't know I don't know what property that is, or whether or not he actually received that check. So I can't really comment on it. But again, checks for large numbers for real estate developers or anybody happens, I think, quite a bit. I mean, there are Russians and Chinese and everybody else who have bought up properties at a wild pace in the U.S. And have paid outrageous sums from $40, $50, $60 million. You know, in general, Donald Trump already had a lot of money, so I don't see how an extra $30, $40, $50 million is somehow he's going to compromise himself for the rest of his life or be beholden to anybody. But again, I'm just speculating.
Right. Well, they've been investigating the so-called Russian collusion narrative for almost 10 months, and I would think, you know, that would be low-hanging fruit. If they were going to come up with some evidence and that was out there, that would have been mentioned by now. And as far as I can see, there is nothing. So far, anyway, we will see. Now, so you you were convicted, you appealed, you lost on the appeal, you served 21 months of a 30-month sentence at, was it Lewisburg Penitentiary Camp? Lewisburg Penitentiary Camp. Was that minimum security?
It is. Or camp is the colloquial term for a minimum security prison.
All right. And what were some of the highs and lows of that experience? I mean, I say highs. I mean, obviously there was a transformative, you know, time in your life. But was there an upside to that for you?
Sure, there was. I mean, some of the lows are, again, and I've said this before on other shows, I don't believe the average American would allow our system of mass incarceration or our federal prison system in general to exist if they could see it with their own eyes and understand what happens there. It is, you know, almost entirely punitive. There's almost no rehabilitative aspect at all. So in the end, you have a 65% recidivism rate or somewhere in that range, meaning two out of every three people who go away to prison come back within 5 years. It's a tremendous cost to our country financially, morally, spiritually, ethically, especially when you consider that many of the crimes that people are persecuted now for, prosecuted now for, are crimes that have not historically been crimes. So I'm talking about, again, you know, if you grow some plants in your basement, which again, people are more getting more liberal on because they see the enormous benefits of marijuana from a medical and a therapeutic, as well as from a personal liberty and a libertarian philosophy. You know, between consenting adults, we charge crimes which shouldn't be charged. I mean, the prison system originally existed for people who were a threat to others or who had created gross violent crimes, whether it's murder, rape, you know, robbery, those types of things. Now our prisons are filled with people, like I said, who referred somebody to a dealer because their friends were coming into town. They wanted to buy marijuana or cocaine or anything else. But, you know, you have to see it to some degree with your own eyes to believe it and to see just what a barbaric system it is in that way. And I'm optimistic that things will change because, again, as information gets out, I don't think people are willing to have a system like that. And as more people go through the system that, you know, can talk about it and write about it like I can, people have a better understanding. But, you know, there was an upside to it, too. There's a silver lining to almost everything. People in prison talk about everything happens for a reason. And I think that's a spiritual crutch to some degree to allow them to go through this experience and keep their sanity and try to keep their optimism and humanity. And I don't believe that. I don't believe everything happens for a reason, but I do believe that everything that happens creates an opportunity if we have the right frame of mind. And in my case, you know, going through it, there were some good things that happened too. So I got sober, which was a positive. I met some tremendous people while I was away. And I know that sounds kind of bizarre, but many of the people I met there, I'm still friends with to this day, and they've done great things since they've come out. And were people who either made a mistake or didn't make a mistake and were caught up unfairly in something, but, you know, made a mistake, admitted their mistake, paid their time and dues to society, and have come out and tried to be positive for their family and society, and have done a good job at that. And, you know, you also got a chance, I got a chance to reflect on life and to become more grateful for the blessings that I had and to take the time to really think about and reprioritize my life and figure out what's important in my life. So in the end, I think our experiences are what make us who we are. And again, it sounds bizarre, but I don't think I would trade it for anything.
You miss being a hedge fund manager?
I do. You know, I miss the intellectual stimulation. I miss pitting myself against the market and other traders. I miss the analysis of it and a lot of things. I don't miss the actual day-to-day work. There's not a lot of interaction with people, staring at a computer screen, you know, for a lot of time, as well as it's the only industry, I think, from a psychological perspective, where you can do, you know, your best homework, your best work, come in and still, at the end of the day, they can take money out of your pocket. And I think that's a very difficult psychological thing to deal with, as opposed to almost every other position where if you actually did a fantastic job and were on the ball and did your homework, you know, you'll tend to get rewarded. In this industry, there are so many externalities and other things out there. I mean, you know, I came into 9/11 and you know, lost a fortune financially. Obviously, people lost a whole lot more than me, but the market was due for a rally. And like I said, something happened that was completely out of my control. Or in Enron, you know, there's fraud. There are so many different things that can happen to disturb somebody's analysis or their position that it's a very difficult psychological job. But it was rewarding as well.
Michael, congratulations on Confessions of a Wall Street Insider. I enjoyed our time together. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. Let me just say real quickly, Amazon cut the price because they knew I was coming on the show, and the book is now $2.99, the electronic Kindle version, for a very limited time. I think it's another day.
Excellent.
So, good time to
all right.
If you're curious.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Richard.
For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Chris Burrows, Greg Bishop, Nathan Staten, Donna Walker, and here in Toronto, Nathan Smith, Scotty Guest, and Alyssa Federighi. Thank you for your ears and your voices. Your beautiful voices. I'm Richard Serrett. So long for now from Coast to Coast AM.